Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and it's Halloween night. Maybe you're listening to this from your car while your kids are going door-to-door trick-or-treating. Or maybe you're hiding in your living room with the lights off because you're out of candy. The unlucky among you might be doing dishes, but I want you to pretend just for the next little while that you're sitting around a campfire bundled up in your winter coat, roasting marshmallows, the glow of firelight flickering on everyone's faces. We're here, my friends, to tell scary stories. I want to start with an idea. The idea that these stories, however spooky and otherworldly, are about real questions and real fears, which is something you understand when you listen to a ghost story from the ghost's perspective. That's what we heard from Mick Cotton one Halloween long ago. He told a story called Ghost Feelings.
People often ask me who I am. I'm a ghost, is what I would say if I didn't have a gaping black hole for a mouth. Some people think I'm their dead relative, that I'm trying to communicate with them, that I have answers. Is there a heaven? Why couldn't you say you loved me? These are all very serious questions, and I would like to say to them, I don't know the answers to these questions. I'm just a ghost. But I have a useless hole for a mouth. I can't tell them anything, so I commit and listen with compassion. Ghosts have always been great listeners.
Those of us telling stories today are not ghosts. We're the ones living with all the haunting questions, all the deep, dark fears, the fears of the living. Are you ready? Here we go. It's Scary Stories on Central Standard. The characters around our campfire are playwright Nathan Lewis Jackson, librarian extraordinaire Katie Stover, and poet Jose Faust. Hi, everyone.
Hi.
So, Nathan, I want to start with you. You're a KCK native, a playwright, a screenwriter. Your big claim to fame is the work you've done on the Netflix show Luke Cage. What do we need to know about your story and why we picked it, why you picked it, I should say, before we hear it?
I don't know. This is a story that I was told a long time ago when I was a kid, and it's a story that I still tell my children. I told them this morning when we woke up for Halloween. So it's a story that's very near and dear to my heart just because it was one that was told to me when I was growing up.
Okay. So can you just tell it now?
Let's tell it. It has several names, but the name that I am familiar with it is Tale of Poe. And it's a story about a man named Old Jack, we'll call him. And Old Jack lived out near the forest, and he lived out there. He was a blacksmith, and is a blacksmith. Could make any tool you want him to make. And Jack was having a tough time this winter. Winter was coming around. It was cold. Business was a little tough. Didn't have a lot in the house to eat. He had been eating on bone soup for pretty much the whole summer with a little loaf of bread. And he had just finished off the last loaf of bread. He had just given his last ounce of meat to his three dogs. His very, very loyal hunting dogs. And he was sitting in a house thinking, what am I going to eat now? I'm kind of hungry. I have nothing. I used to have a wife, and she cooked for me, but his wife had died maybe the winter ago. So he'd been sitting there thinking about her, thinking about her smile, thinking about her voice, thinking about the good meals she used to make, and he was pretty hungry. Instead of going back and drinking some more bone soup, he decided, I'll just go to bed and wake up and try again in the morning. So he was sitting there in the living room in front of the fire, dozing off. And the thing about Old Jack is Old Jack didn't like to lock the door to his house. His wife would always remind him, hey, man, lock the door. He wouldn't do it. And on this night, he may have paid the price. As he's dozing off, he sees a shadowy figure kind of creep in the door, very quietly, so quietly even his three dogs didn't hear it. And the shadowy figure creeps inside the house. It's large, hairy, dark, massive, massive, long tail. And he sees this thing, and he jumps up, and he grabs his axe, and the creature growls at him. And he thinks he's in for a fight, but the creature doesn't want to fight tonight. The creature tries to make a beeline to the door, run out. Out of fear, Jack takes his axe and he swipes at the creature, cutting off the creature's tail. He shuts the door behind him. He's breathing heavy. He locks the door this time. He's learned his lesson, turns around and sees this tail lying there. And he thinks, I'm just going to throw this thing out. Maybe the dogs will eat it. But he says, why should the dogs just enjoy this tail? Looks pretty meaty. So he looks at the fire in the fireplace, thinks of roasting it, puts the tail over the fire, starts to roast the tail. Smells pretty good. Takes a bite. It is pretty good. He eats most of it. It fills him up. He has some left over to give to his three hounds. They eat part of they eat the rest of the tail. And everybody's feeling good. And he says, I'm just going to go to bed tonight. Jumps in the bed, starts to doze off until he hears a scratching on the side of the wall. A very deep, deep scratching on the side of the wall. And he says, oh, what is that? And then he hears a growl, similar to the growl that he heard when the creature was in the house. And this time, along with the growl, he hears a voice. And the voice says, Tailapo, Tailapo, give me back my Tailapo. And now he's completely freaked out. So he jumps up, he calls his dogs, hey, get him, sick him, go boys, go. And the dogs run and they chase the creature away. And he's feeling a little better, but still really freaked out, pats his dogs on the head, they did a great job, goes back to bed. Doesn't take long before he hears that same scratching on the side of the wall. Again, a really, really deep scratching, almost as if this creature he thinks it is actually scratching through the side of his house, his cabin. And he does the same thing. He jumps up. Hey, get him. Sick him, boys. Go, go. And the dogs run out, this time chasing the creature deep back into the forest. But the dogs don't come back. And he's a little worried, but he's thinking maybe they just got lost or maybe they found a squirrel or something to play with. That happens sometimes. And he's sitting in the bed hoping they're okay. And he hears the same scratching, deeper, and the same voice. Tailapo, Tailapo, give me back my Tailapo. And he's really, really freaked out. Now he calls his dogs. Dogs, go get him. Sick him, sick him. But there's no dogs around. And then he hears the voice say, your dogs ain't coming back. And now he's scared out of his wits. Tailapo, Tailapo, give me back my Tailapo. And now whatever it is has scratched his way into the house because he can hear the voice from in the living room. He's in the bedroom with the covers over his head, not knowing what to do. And he hears the same scratching at the bedroom door. Tailapo, Tailapo, give me back my Tailapo. And now the creature has scratched his way into his bedroom, clawed through the wall, and it's right down by the foot of the bed. And he looks and he sees these giant ears and he sees this giant teeth and he sees these glowing eyes. And it's creeping over the top of the bed. Tailapo, Tailapo, give me back my Tailapo. And now this creature has jumped onto the bed and is snarling over him. Tailapo, Tailapo, give me back my Tailapo. Hairy, large, foul breath. And he looks right at the creature and he's scared. He says, I don't have your Tailapo. I ate it. I ate it. And the creature looks at him even more angry now. I'm going to get my Tailapo. And a lot of people don't know what happened to old Jack. But the legend is that the creature did, in fact, get his Tailapo back piece by piece.
Whoa. Yeah, that's the thing about a scary story. You can't expect a happy ending, can you?
Now, my children before I left said that I should finish a story that Jack and the monster made up, and he actually didn't eat the tail, and he gave it back to him, and they were friends. But that doesn't have the same effect, does it?
No. and it, you know, all the things that you've set up, how else could that story end?
That's pretty much about it. Once you eat that tail, I think it's curtains for old Jack.
All right, that story was told by Kansas City's Nathan Lewis Jackson. I have many questions, but I want to hear one more story first. This one's from Jose Faust. And Jose, you wrote your story, but it is based on a folktale.
Yeah, it is. It's actually, it's called El Silbón. It's a Colombian folktale. I heard it when I was a little kid, but I didn't really understand what the story was about. And then just in thinking back about some things, I wrote the story for a conference. And then kind of looked at it and said, I like it. So I brought it back up and redid it again.
Okay, let's hear it. Ready, set, go.
My first Holy Communion provides the excuse for the family gathering at Doña Emerita's house. The day threatens rain. The adults filled the dining room with chatter. My cousins and I chase each other in and out of the house. At the sound of a spoon hitting a crystal glass, the adults gather at the large table in the middle. The youngest children sit on the smaller tables lining the wall. The adults' conversation is intense, with voices rising and diminishing. Us children eat and laugh. After dinner, the adults disperse to other conversations, while I, my cousins, run around the house. Some of the men step out into the courtyard and light their cigars. In time, the chatter congregates in the parlor in the canasta table. My grandmother is a canasta champion, and my uncle Rafa is considered a master player. As a team, they are unbeatable. In fairness, they hardly ever team up, except tonight. The teams wait nervously until their turn to step up to the sacrificial altar. It is not a fair night, as one by one, teams of uncles, aunts, cousins, and family friends are vanquished. In time, all drift out of the parlor. Children are gathered and spirited to the room. My aunt leads my brother and me to our room. Soon we are asleep. Something wakes me. I sit up and look around in the darkness. I make my way to the closest window, open it, and unlatch the shutters. The threatened rain has arrived, announced by the insistent thumping of drops on the tiled roofs. The dim courtyard, lights reflect in the pools that gather on the patio floor. Suddenly, the dark is filled by a flash of white light and the rain's patter silenced by a sharp clap of thunder. Across the courtyard, our light comes on. I see in the brief brightness a figure wrapped in a poncho. It moves in the haze towards the light of the gazebo. The light goes off. In that instant, an eerie whistle fills the yard. Ascending and descending, do re mi fa sol la ti do notes resonate off the walls. The whistle is intermittent. At first, barely audible, at other times close enough to feel the inside of my head, the sharpness of the notes makes me shudder. In the gazebo, I can make out an orange glow like an ember. Slowly, the lights in some of the rooms are turned on. I see my tia Imelda exit from one of the rooms. Quickly, the lights of the kitchen and the dining hall come on, and a steady stream of adults and children begin to gather in the dining room, where only hours before we had gathered for dinner. I quickly close the shutters, wake my brother just in time to my aunt opening the door and quietly calling our names. Children, come quickly. We have to go to the house. My aunt takes my brother's hand. My cousin Patricia grabs mine and pulls me close to her. You and I are going to stay together, she whispers. In an instant, I fall in love with her. Sweets, coffees, juices, milk, and stouter offerings fill the tables. My uncle Guillermo laughs nervously. It is an old wives' tale. These myths are dangerous. Look at us all gathered here for what? Afraid of a whistle. I bet you it is the wind moving around and through the structure. Another uncle dares the room into silence. Let's see if it is the sound of the house. For minutes, the room is quiet. Suddenly, the unmistakable order of the safacho fills the air. The notes are accompanied by the sound of sticks, like a metronome of bones. Patricia squeezes my hand. Be careful. Someone is going to die tonight, she shouts. My aunt quickly pulls her next to her, breaking our hold. Now, my sweet, no such thing is going to happen. Who told you this? Our teacher told us the story of El Silbón and how he killed his father and how he will roam forever with his bones on his back, whistling and looking for victims. He is here. Don't you hear him? My uncle Guillermo breaks the awkward void. The things they teach our kids nowadays. No wonder some people think us backwards. As he speaks, his hand is balled into a fist. His other hand holds a drink, a slight tremor in his arm. The words El Silbón fill the room, bringing tears to the faces of some of the younger cousins and nervous laughter from the adults. Gaps of silence add to the discomfort. I notice my grandmother is not in the room. Someone asks where Tio Rafa is. We need to look for them. I make sure they are okay, I shout. Oh, they are probably somewhere together, having a drink, smoking a cigar, and counting their winnings. A nervous laughter bounces off the walls, but soon the silence returns, and anxious faces wait for the whistle. In that moment, I break away, head to the French door, slide them open, and enter the corridor. The lights are out on this side of the house, but down the hall, I see a light under the edge of a door. I make my way to it, grab the handle, carefully turn it, open it a crack. Silhouetted by the light from the gazebo, I see my grandmother, one arm on the windowsill, the other cigar in hand, waving towards the gazebo. I see Tio Rafa waving his ember in response. I hear the muffled laughter of mi abuela as the scale loudly fills the courtyard one more time. I slowly close the door. Back in the dining room, I hold Patricia's hand until sleep overcomes us. Somehow, we are all in our rooms and asleep. The next day, the house is a frenzy. Standing in the courtyard, I see my grandmother and Tio Rafa sitting in the gazebo. My tio shouts, Venga aquí, José Enrique. I hesitate until my grandmother yells, "Venga, Cuckoo." I walk slowly. It was a long night last night, wasn't it, Cuckoo? Sí, abuelita, it was a long night. Sometimes it is better to stay under the covers and not stare into the dark, says Tio with a big smile on his face. Today you will be filled with the Holy Spirit, my grandmother says. I saw you last night in the rain, I accused them. Everyone was afraid. They thought El Silbón was here, but it was you. I heard you. Were you afraid, asked Tio? Yes. Why did you do that? There are stories we tell each other from the beginning of time. It is what makes us who we are, explains Tio. We need these stories more than ever, Cuckoo, says my grandmother. Pity a people who no longer believe in their stories. That is a people that are dead. Someday you will tell stories. Promise me you will believe them with all your heart. I will, I tell her, as she wraps me tightly in her arms.
Jose Faust, everyone, the writer and teller of that tale. So, you guys, both of these scary stories are personalized variations on folktales. What is it about a folktale? I mean, the end of your story, Jose, kind of gets at it, that it travels through generations and that there's this thread that connects people in these stories.
Right, and you can be an adult and believe in them or not, dismiss them. But when you're caught in the frenzy of one, you kind of revert back to being that child. I like that description of the uncle who believes definitely that these are folk myths, but his arm is slightly trembling. It's just those little things that give it away for kids.
So, Nathan, what do you think about, like, the story of your story?
Like I said, it's something about the story that triggered me as a kid, that stuck with me. And I'm not sure what it is. I think it was always, for me, it's the ending, actually, because there's different variations of the story. It's been told, it's a folktale that's been told throughout American history. And the ending that I've always liked, that I kind of did this time, was they don't tell you what happened to old Jack. They just give you an impression that, you know, the monster got his tail back. To me, scary stories,
they leave the rest to the imagination.
Oh my God, those are the best. Those are the best stories. I don't need to, you know, when you look at slasher films or all that, I don't need, that stuff doesn't appeal to me as much as when I have to, when you force me to use my imagination. It's much, much more effective.
Well, so Katie, you have brought in a different type of scary story.
Yes, I brought in three short shorts. I like these short stories because they pack a lot of punch. They are concise in their storytelling. And I realized I wasn't after this theme in particular, but all three of these short shorts concern fears around children. And maybe because when I was younger, the scary movies that scared me the most were Audrey Rose, Children of the Corn, and The Exorcist. And they scared me the most because there were children as central figures in those films. And that was frightening to me, that there was someone that might be a classmate who was possessed the way Audrey Rose was.
That there may be dangers your parents or
right.
other adults can't protect you from.
Yes, and we don't expect the horror to come to us through children. And when it does, it's twice as frightening because how strong could that horror possibly be that it can embody a child? And how do you, as an adult, extinguish the horror? That's
okay.
a moral challenge
yeah.
to one's
<I'll>
soul.
Say. Well, so Katie, tell us these stories. Start with just one.
My daughter learned to count. My daughter woke me around 11:50 last night. My wife and I had picked her up from her friend Sally's birthday party, brought her home, and put her to bed. My wife went into the bedroom to read while I fell asleep watching the baseball game. Mommy, she whispered, tugging my shirt sleeve, guess how old I'm going to be next month? I don't know, sweetie, how old? She smiled a tooth-gapped smile and held up four fingers. It is 7:30 now. My wife and I have been up with her for almost 8 hours. She still refuses to tell us where she got them.
Oh, that is creepy.
That's what I was going for.
That is creepy. Because you think you know what's going on, and then you don't.
No, and what's great about this story is that it plays with a game we have always played with children. How old are you? Or guess how old I am.
Hold up the fingers.
And you hold up your fingers, and what did this kid do? And then the way this story ends is what keeps the horror keep going, which is there's no answer to the question, and there's no answer to the question, and it
can't be good, whatever it is.
It can't be good, and the parents are staring at their child whom they don't know anymore.
I just got chills. Okay, next short.
This short is extremely short. It's a bedtime story. I begin tucking him into bed, and he tells me, "Mommy, check for monsters under my bed." I look beneath, under his bed for his amusement, and see him, another him, under the bed, staring back at me, quivering and whispering, "Mommy, there's somebody on my bed."
Everybody here is like laughing, but I think it's also like creepy laughing.
It's creepy laughing. And what makes these scary and fun is we get to take a situation that is mundane. We've all done this. We've all seen this. We've all read this. And someone has put a very creative, horrific twist on it.
Okay, final story.
Last one. 1001. The Moors are having a baby. I glanced up from the table, surprised. They got the okay? My husband nodded. The paperwork came in today, so I heard. He lowered his eyes in sorrow. Poor Joanna. She's only 53, I said. A bead of sweat dripped down my brow, landing on the cool concrete floor of the bunker. I tried to remind myself to be thankful for this place, this concrete tomb, but it grew more difficult each day. Perpetuum Technologies, the company that sprung up just in time for the largest nuclear war the world had ever seen, had designed the vault to sustain 1,000 people for as long as it took the surface to be habitable again. Exactly 1,000 people. Poor Joanna, indeed.
That is, yeah, and that taps into so many fears right now about the future of the world and survival and, yeah, deep, dark survival of the fittest kind of stuff.
Right. And if we want to go a little further, what does happen if we, as a human race, find ourselves in this situation? And in order to procreate, who leaves the bunker to keep the race going?
The spooky, spooky end. Katie Stover, Jose Faust, Nathan Lewis Jackson. This has been fun and frightening, and I really, really appreciate it. Thank you so much for sharing your stories, and happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween.
Thank you.
I'm Gina Kaufman. When Central Standard returns, ghost towns in Kansas and beyond. When is a town so dead that it qualifies as a ghost town? What is a ghost town tourist doing? And can you bring a ghost town back to life? That's next. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and now ghost towns. There are 141 of them in the state of Kansas alone. 141. Think about that. That is a lot. Ghost towns are a significant part of our landscape, part of our story. But aside from a particular subset of travelers who love visiting ghost towns, we don't give them much thought, out of sight, out of mind. But how did these towns become abandoned, and are they truly abandoned, or are reports of their deaths sometimes exaggerated? We'll get answers to those questions starting with a ghost town expert, Gary Speck. He's written two books about ghost towns all over America. My first question is, do you consider the ghost town a specifically American phenomenon, or are they everywhere?
They are everywhere. Canada, Australia, New Zealand, throughout Europe, Middle East, and so forth. So they're all over the world.
Within the U.S., there are regional differences, though, right?
That is correct.
Talk to me about those. Talk to me about where you find ghost towns and how the character changes from one region to another?
Well, ghost towns sort of followed the development pattern of the United States. On the East Coast, you had places like Jamestown that were early colonies, Roanoke Colony in North Carolina. And as the settlers moved, a lot of the old colony sites were abandoned. Forts were established, and they would be abandoned. Throughout the, as civilization moved west, we had areas in the heartland states like Kansas, Nebraska, Missouri, Iowa, where a lot of little farming towns were established. And when the railroads would come through, sometimes those farming towns would be in the wrong spot, so they would end up putting the railroad through into a different location, and then the towns would move, and the old sites would be abandoned. A lot of times they were along river bottoms, used as ferries and so forth. And in the West, most of the mining towns, or most of the ghost towns, are the result of mining towns. Gold or silver would be found. They would be boom towns. Once the gold or silver was exhausted, then the towns would usually fade away. Sometimes they were in a location where they could remain alive as a road town or a railroad town or some kind of a travel center. But most of the mining towns just faded out as time went on.
What about the Midwest?
The Midwest was mostly farming towns, agricultural towns. Sometimes they were speculative, like a county seat. A county would be established in the middle of Kansas or Missouri, and they would say, hey, this is a good spot to put a town. Well, when the railroad would come through, they would say, yeah, wrong spot. Or political issues, you know, they would say, you know, whoever had the best location, probably the most favors it, set the county seat up there.
Is that partly related to the Civil War, too? Just that there were sort of two forces competing to emerge as the standard, and that one of those faded away?
Especially in Kansas and Missouri, that's true. Colonies were established. I know in Kansas there were several African-American colonies that were established by freed slaves. And as the state grew up and did not become a slave state, or Missouri did not become a slave state, then a lot of those colonies faded out.
Is there an agreed-upon definition of the word ghost town? Are there criteria that need to be met?
In general, Webster calls a ghost town a once flourishing town that was wholly or partially deserted as a result of the exhaustion of a natural resource. So that's kind of the dictionary definition of a ghost town. I personally expand on it a little bit. That includes any place that had a center of commerce, or like a cluster of houses, and then for whatever reason they were abandoned. But they do come in various categories, too. You can have completely barren sites. You can have areas where there's ruins. You can have we call a classic ghost town, like Bodie, California, which is just standing abandoned buildings with no people living there. And those are extremely rare now, and they're getting rarer as time goes on. And then you have what most people consider not ghost towns, but they can be ghost towns, and that are semi-ghost towns. And a lot of the little farming towns throughout the Midwest would be in that category, where maybe they have 50 people living where 500 or 1,000 once lived. And then there's also the busy historic communities, which are like Virginia City, Nevada, Williamsburg, Virginia, Deadwood, South Dakota, Tombstone, Arizona, that they are smaller than they were during their historic past when they were booming towns, but they're still an active chamber of commerce and they are active communities. So technically they're not ghost towns, but they fall into that category of faded towns.
What is it about ghost towns that interests you? Enough that you have written two books on the subject. Is there a larger story they tell in your mind, or a serious question they demand answers to?
Not so much that they demand answers, because each ghost town is unique. They have their own unique personalities. But I'm looking at them as a place where people had dreams of establishing themselves, be it a miner or a citizen that's just wanting to live someplace different, form a community of people with like minds, and they all lived together, and they had hopes and dreams of making it big and, you know, making the town big, and usually those dreams got dashed. And it's the feeling of the community that's still there or was there that draws me. It's not so much a tangible thing as much as an intangible thing.
So you're curious about the dreams and, like, the alternate reality they envisioned.
Well, you could have a town. I'm thinking of a little farming town in Colorado. 500 people were living there. They had a car dealership. They had all kinds of stuff. They had everything going for them. Dust Bowl came. Crops dried up, people went bankrupt and escaped to go to the city. Just imagine the heartache that these people felt as they had to leave their towns, the place that they thought that they would be able to settle forever. And when you go there and you see the abandoned homes or the abandoned stores, you can feel that desperation as the people left.
Do you know of any ghost towns anywhere that have made a comeback and somehow repopulated?
A few. I know there's a lot of them where the population is still there and they're kind of hanging on by the skin of their teeth, but they're looking at ways to revitalize. And one in specific that I can think of here in California is a little town out along old Route 66, which brings back many memories for people that did road trips through the 50s and 60s. It's a little town called Amboy. 20 years ago, it was basically an abandoned outpost in the desert with a couple of people living there. The owners of the town now are actually restoring it. The gas station has been restored. The cafe is undergoing restoration. There's plans to restore the motel. And as a result, it's attracting a lot of Route 66 roadies and a lot of international travelers. So they're starting to pick up tourism. I know in other states there are locations that are doing the same thing. I don't know of any specific names, though.
So this brings me to our next guest, Deborah Bryan. She's a doctor, a physician, but she's become the leader of a grassroots effort to revitalize a Kansas ghost town by the name of White Cloud. It's right on Scenic Highway 7. It's near a casino, so if you've been there or driven past it, those are the two very likely reasons why. Describe White Cloud as it appears today.
White Cloud was a town that was established in 1855, and it's surrounded by the glacial hills. It was a Iowa tribal land that became sold to the U.S. government, and then about five men took the land and they sold off lots. They had a big party one day and sold off lots to the townspeople. And that's how the town started. It was a major town because of its steam ferry that was rapidly taking people across the Missouri River.
But what does it look like today?
Today it looks very similar to how it looked in 1855. They basically cut a road down through the middle of a glacial hill right to the Missouri River. And it's very similar today looking as it was in 1855, which is a beautiful part of White Cloud.
Do people specifically seek it out for its ghost town-like qualities?
It has a lot of draw because it has a flea market that's been going for 50 years, twice a year. So that brings lots of people. Some of those people have been coming since 1970s. And it has that scenic Highway 7. It also has the Eighth Wonder of Kansas, which is the lookout that you can see four states from the lookout. And it has a beautiful school that's still preserved with an active historical society.
Why is it considered a ghost town right now?
It went from 2,000 people to 176 people. Many people came in town to buy the buildings to flea market twice a year, and then they don't do anything else to them the rest of the year. So they deteriorated, and it pretty much became a ghost town from that aspect.
I understand that there is one building, and I don't know what the building is, but one building in White Cloud that gets photographed and shared a lot.
It is the depot that was down on the river where the present Highway 7 is. It was moved up to the main street, and it was the A&N Railroad Depot. A few years ago, three women in the community took it upon themselves, and they got the entire main street of White Cloud on the National Register, which there's only two towns in Kansas that have that. So they really did a lot of work in getting all the architecture of all the buildings and the town on that registry.
But the character of the state of the building today is part of what intrigues people, right?
It is. It's got things hanging off the front. It's got a really unique door. The windows in front have, surprisingly to me, not been knocked out. And people will stand with tripods and they photograph that. The seniors come and want their pictures taken in front of that building.
What is it that is sad to you about where the town stands right now, so much so that you are trying to turn things around?
Well, this town is named after my third grandfather back, Chief Francis Whitecloud. So it has a lot of meaning to me, and I get frustrated with the people that don't see the beauty of what is around them to restore these and take better care of this town and to jump on board. But as they see these buildings that I'm doing, I've bought four, that what I'm doing, you can see that it's generating interest and the love of their town, and people are looking at it different. They're looking at, if this woman comes in and sees my town different, maybe I need to take a different look. So, for example, a woman went and bought flower pots to mimic the plaza here in Kansas City and put the flowers in it and had two young men watering them all summer. And they really were beautiful.
The idea that people leave and that's why a town becomes a ghost town, it seems like you're putting the sort of reverse spin on that, which is if you take care of the structures and bring life to the structures, that the people will come back. Have you seen that?
I definitely think that that's where my thought process is. I did some research about what do people look in a town that they live in. And the number one thing, surprisingly, is beauty. Because people can actually work from all areas now. There's many towns that are offering like $10,000 to come and work out of their town. And they have the center that they provide for them. Well, I also read that if you bring four things back at once, which is why I bought four buildings. So we're working on the French Canoe Cafe. We've got the general store and opera house restored. We're now looking at the old newspaper chief building to make it a little bed and breakfast.
You know, you've talked a little bit about your personal connection to the town of White Cloud. Is there something personal that would be lost if this town did not successfully revitalize for you? Would you have that feeling that you had suffered a personal loss of some kind?
Oh, I certainly would. I have pictures of my grandparents in full Indian dress, you know, from White Cloud rodeo and parades. I personally used to rodeo there at the White Cloud Horse Arena. The river there, I heard people talk about when they'd go to Rulo, Nebraska, 10 miles away, and they would have canoe races down to White Cloud and have a trophy. And all these things that I've heard these people talk about White Cloud and my family's involvement with the name would be definitely lost for me.
How did this whole project actually begin of trying to revitalize White Cloud?
I would drive through there on my way to work. And I would look at these buildings and I'm like, that is such a cool building. I want to know what's going on in there. I want to see in there. And then when I'd go into the building, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. They do not make buildings like this anymore. And I just got this, it's just sort of took, like the gentleman who's wrote the two books, it just sort of was a spirit in me that started. And I said, I can do this. I can do this. I've never restored anything. I didn't know how to do it. And I just said, I'm going to learn. I've learned a lot about construction in the last 3 years.
Tell me about the 176 people who are still there out of the 2,000 who once populated White Cloud. How do they feel about this, and what's holding them there in White Cloud?
Lots of families that have been there for generations, and they there's older, 80s, and they know everything about the town and the history. And then there's the younger group, the young couple that bought the owner of my building's home up the street. They have four kids and they commute from there. They bought a beautiful, beautiful home. The homes are very reasonably priced. The Poulette house went for $8,000, and it's a triple with a cupola and the imported France iron on the back, all brick. They find that they can really live there cheaply, and they love the town's flavor.
But what are I know that, of course, you are passionate about the positives. What is it that they don't have as of now if they're going to live in White Cloud? What is it that would be maybe missing that people might typically expect of their communities or their infrastructure?
There's not one pop machine on the main street. You cannot buy anything. There is one business, two businesses. There's an elevator, green elevator, and there is an Echo Water store by locals that own it. Other than that, there is nothing that in the town open.
Dr. Deborah Bryan, thank you so
much. Thank you.
Gary, does the story you just heard about the town of White Cloud that's not going down gently, they're putting up a serious fight to stay relevant, does that story complicate things?
Not in the least. It's actually a very wonderful story because they're saving the history of that community. And by revitalizing, they're bringing life back to it. And even though it will be new, it will also remain true to its roots. And I think a lot of those people that live there will feel a lot more optimistic about the future of the community. And I think that Mrs. Bryan has really got a great idea to bring life back to the community. And because it's close enough to Kansas City that it can be commutable, I think that helps a lot in the process.
Is there, though, I love the happy ending, and I want that to be what we get, but is there something to be said for letting nature take its course? Or would the argument be none of this is natural at all? The birth, life, and death of a town is all based on what we do, what we decide.
In a lot of cases, yes, because a lot of the towns, when they were built, they were not built for permanence. They were built for the moment, whether it be farming or mining. And as a result, once that economic base is gone and the town's lost its viability, when the people leave, a lot of times they'll take the buildings with them, tear them down, use them for firewood or whatever. But when they come back and put money into the communities, it can help them. I know there are several in New Mexico that artist colonies were established in the 1970s during the hippie era. And those towns actually came back. And I'm thinking specifically of a little place called Madrid. It looks like the Madrid, Spain, but it's actually pronounced Madrid. It was a coal mining town. And today it's a wonderful little town to stop in and have an ice cream or visit some of the little chachi stores. You know, you can buy all kind of little art pieces for your garden and so forth. So if people do put the money into them, they can make a comeback. And it still does remain a viable place for people like me that like the history, because the history is right there, still visible.
You like the history, but would you say that you like ghost towns, or do you find them sad?
I actually love them. I have a very strong passion for them. They don't make me sad in the respect that this is where people lived and are now gone. It's just been a part of my life for so long. I don't really have that negative emotion to them. To me, they're very positive. And I feel very good when I visit a town that there are a few people there and they're trying to make inroads to make them better. And I see it as a positive because they are, like I said, they are reviving the history of the community.
Well, there are lots of people who like ghost towns, not just people like Gary who have written multiple books about them, and people who go out of their way to visit. They find visiting places and the quality of abandonedness fun. That's what I want to hear about now. Our next guest is Caitlin Morton. She's a contributing editor for Condé Nast Traveler, and she's based in Kansas City. She co-wrote an article for the magazine called Ghost Towns of America, and the opening line of the article is, "There's something oddly alluring about abandoned towns." So what is alluring? Can you put your finger on it about abandoned towns from a traveler's perspective?
For me, ghost towns, especially ones in the United States, they're kind of like these open-air museums where if you're on a road trip or even if you're visiting as a standalone destination, you are visiting this frozen moment in time. And to me, it's the same as visiting a museum exhibit, visiting Mount Rushmore, visiting the Liberty Bell. It just is this slice of history that you get to see with your own eyes.
So instead of a curator, you just have the passage of time.
Exactly.
You picked 17 of these towns. Can you tell me about a few of your favorites?
Sure. Gary mentioned Bodie, California. That one to me is like the epitome of a Wild West, John Ford setting kind of ghost town in California. It's in a desert setting. It has a saloon with swinging doors and a dusty old piano. You can look in the houses and you can see that plates are still on the tables. The pillows are still on the beds. It's this just kind of beautiful state of arrested decay that is really nice. And it's protected by the National Park Service, so you don't have graffiti, you don't have piles of trash everywhere. And my personal favorite, I'd say, is Centralia, Pennsylvania. It's a little different than most of the ghost towns you'll find in the West. It was, abandoned in the 80s because of a fire underground in the mines that are connected by tunnels. And this fire started in the 60s, and it just kept burning, and eventually the people had to leave. But it just is this creepy kind of fascinating thing of this subterranean fire that just won't stop burning.
Have you been to any around here or know of any that people who are into ghost towns seem to really, really like?
I haven't personally been to any around here. I know people really love the ones in California, Montana, Nevada. They're really close to national parks, and so they are kind of easy detours if you're on a road trip. I think the White Cloud that we were talking about sounds absolutely amazing, and it has that historic element that makes it really fascinating. It's by the river. I would absolutely encourage people to visit that.
Do you think that visiting places as ghost towns, that something for the tourism piece of it would be lost if the town revitalized and became a present-day, totally functional town? Like, part of what you're talking about is walking into that kitchen where the plates are still on the table, or walking through the saloon doors where dust has accumulated on the piano keys.
Yeah, I do think part of that kind of fascination, this air of mystery, would be lost a little, but I do think that if there's a surge in popularity, it wouldn't necessarily harm the state of the site itself. Look at Chernobyl, which is arguably the most famous ghost town in the world. It has seen such a surge in popularity over the past year, mostly because of the HBO show, like a 30% increase from last year. And it still is exactly the same as it was last year. There are some ghost towns that I know have little Airbnbs in them, like Cisco, Utah. And it's almost like it adds another reason for people to visit. Like, oh, you can stay in this old post office, or you can have a reception in this beautiful banquet hall. But the state of the town is relatively the same. So I think if you have people respecting it and retaining that history about it, then I don't see any harm in it.
In Condé Nast Traveler, a lot of the photographs you typically see are like beautiful beaches with azure waters, or like a grand mountain with purple and snowy cap on top. Right. The photograph that begins this list of 17 ghost towns to visit is this equally glorious looking photograph with the sunset and kind of like ruins that might, on first glance, you'd think of maybe like Greece or Rome or something. When you put an article like that in Condé Nast Traveler, which is sort of for, in some ways, like the traveler with means, mm-hmm. Do you think that you elevate these places?
I think so. Places don't necessarily have to be far away or expensive or super exotic to be of interest to travelers. Everyone loves a good story. Everyone loves, a slice of history, a little piece of Americana, like a little quirkiness. And I think they are beautiful in and of their own rights. You don't have to travel to Pompeii. You can just go to Nevada. It's the same type of appeal, but it's way more accessible for a lot of at least U.S.-based readers.
Yeah. One place used to have gladiators. Mm-hmm. Another used to have miners.
Right. Exactly.
Gary Speck, before we go, is there a misconception about ghost towns that you'd like to clear up, or just something about them that people tend not to know or get that you think they should know or get?
I think that the mystique about ghost towns is most people, when they think about ghost towns, they think about abandoned buildings. You know, it looks like an Old West movie set. You know, abandoned buildings, the window panes kind of dirty. You got curtains flapping in the breeze. You've got coyotes wandering down the main street with tumbleweeds. That ain't true. In real life, that may have been true back in the early 1900s when these towns were recently abandoned. But today, the vast majority of ghost towns are either forgotten sites, rubbled sites, like the Pompeii ruins that Caitlin mentioned, or just small towns with just a few people in there hanging on. And that's the reality of it. And they're really magical places. They're not just empty buildings. They're actually places where people live or lived. And these communities have a lot of misconceptions about them. But when you get down to really know them and feel them and visit them, you can quickly forget the stereotypes, because each one, like I mentioned earlier, is an individual, and they live and they breathe even though they may not be alive.
Our time is up, but Gary Speck, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Gary Speck is the author of two books about ghost towns, Ghost Towns Yesterday and Today, and Dust in the Wind, A Guide to American Ghost Towns. This has been a special Halloween edition of KCUR's Central Standard. If you missed the earlier part of the show while answering the door for trick-or-treaters, you can find the whole thing online, kcur.org/centralstandard. Tune in at our regular time tomorrow for a First Friday art show. We've got a book reading, a painting exhibit, and a Day of the Dead festival to tell you about. That and more tomorrow morning at 10. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell, Mackenzie Martin, Noah Taborda, and Ann Kniggendorf. Special thanks to Steven Steigman for this evening's production. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Happy Halloween.